We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Wolverine fans, welcome to our first edition of Conquering Heroes. I'm your host, John Jansen. We've been talking about this podcast for a couple of weeks, so I'm excited to bring it to you today on our initial launch of Conquering Heroes. More than 2 years ago, we started in the trenches, and we wanted to provide you, the fans, with as much Michigan football information and coverage as we possibly could. But over the time that we were doing in the trenches, we would branch off and we would talk to other coaches, other athletes, other things that were going on. We want to make Conquering Heroes the one-stop shop for all things Michigan athletics. So taking into account what we heard from you and the fact that you liked hearing from more than just the football program, we've generated Conquering Heroes. And this podcast is going to be part of a network. That network is MGO Blue Podcast with John Jansen, and it will house In the Trenches. It will house Conquering Heroes. Each week, we're going to bring you the latest in Michigan athletics news, notes, updates. To start the podcast, we will give you a quick update, about 5 minutes or so, depending on what time of year and what's going on with Michigan athletics. And it's going to involve the news and notes around campus. Then we're going to have our feature guest. Today, that guest is going to be Daryl Conway, Senior Associate Athletic Director and Chief Health and Welfare Officer. He's going to talk to us about reintroducing the student athletes that are continuing to come back to campus and how the testing is going, what the protocol is in place, what the fall sports season looks like. We're going to talk to him in just a few minutes. As with In the Trenches, Conquering Heroes will continue to evolve, so we want to hear from you as we dive into this podcast, what you like, what you want to hear. If you have an athlete at Michigan, a coach, or a story that you want to know more about, get in touch with us. You can find me on Twitter at JohnJansen77. You can also email us, MichiganWolverinesRadio@gmail.com, or you can text us at 734-328-1760. When you do that, please subscribe, review, comment. Ultimately, this network is what we want to give you as the fans, the information inside Michigan athletics. Take down that veil a little bit and give you a peek behind as to what's going on with the student athletes, with the coaches, with the teams, with the programs. And I couldn't be more excited to bring this to you along with everybody else at Michigan that has worked to put this together. So without further ado, here is your debut episode of Conquering Heroes.
Welcome to your one-stop podcast for all things Michigan athletics. Updates on every team on campus and interviews with players and coaches are all on the way. This is Conquering Heroes. Here's your host, John Jansen.
Welcome back, friends, and we're going to jump right into the news and notes around Michigan athletics, and we're going to start with COVID-19. Testing update from the athletic department, which came out on Friday. 276 more tests were taken, 9 positive tests. That brings our overall number of tests to just over 1,000 with 1,005 total tests. The positive numbers, 29 total positive results, just under 3% overall. And again, I mentioned Daryl Conway will be joining us. We'll get to him to talk about the testing protocols in regards to 18 sports that student athletes are currently on campus for. Next, we're going to go to hockey. The hockey program has elected its captains for the season. Who's going to be the leaders of this hockey team? Senior Jack Becker and junior Strauss Mann are the captains. Juniors Nick Blankenberg and Jimmy Lambert are the alternate captains. And speaking of hockey, 16 former Wolverines are part of this weekend's NHL restart in Toronto and Edmonton, including 5 on teams that have earned a bye to the conference quarterfinals, and that's set to start next week. Women's basketball, assistant coach Toyel Wilson has joined the Coaches for Change organization, which was founded by college basketball coaches who are dedicated to helping their student athletes, their campus, and their communities. Coaches for Change's mission is to provide a platform that engages, educates, empowers, and evolves the collegiate student athlete on issues of social injustice, systemic racism, and the power of voting in the endless pursuit of equality. On to women's golf. 2 members of the Wolverines are competing in the U.S. Women's Amateur at Woodmont Country Club. They'll both tee off for their second rounds on Tuesday morning. Follow along if you want to on Twitter. Their Twitter handle is at UMitchWGolf. There are also plenty of awards coming out. Several Michigan programs collected some individual and team-wide honors in recent weeks. For the first time in program history, the volleyball team won the Team Academic Award, which honors programs with a team GPA of 3.3 or better. The Wolverines had 11 academic All-Big Ten honorees. 9 women and 6 men from Michigan's track and field teams earned All-Academic honors, and both teams took home the collective All-Academic Awards, the women for their 9th straight year and the men for their 5th straight year. In tennis, 5 women and the team as a whole were honored as All-Academic. 4 members of the men's team were also All-Academic performers. And 14 members of the water polo program earned All-Academic awards, the most for the Wolverines since the creation of these honors back in 2002. And if you're looking for something to quench your Wolverine thirst for Michigan athletics, each year, MGoBlue.com does a great feature. It's called the Photos of the Year. Check out the top picks of Michigan's outstanding photographers. Go to MGoBlue.com. Now, I teased it, and we're going to get to it. Daryl Conway, who is the Senior Associate Athletic Director and Chief Health and Welfare Officer for Student Athletes, has joined us to talk about what is going on in regards to COVID on campus with the athletic department. Enjoy the conversation that I had with Daryl Conway. As I mentioned, our first guest on Conquering Heroes is Daryl Conway. And Daryl is the Senior Associate Athletic Director, Chief Health and Welfare Officer for Student Athletes. And he has also just been appointed to the state's athletic trainers board by Governor Whitmer and her group. Daryl, first of all, thanks for joining us and congratulations on the appointment.
Thank you. Thank you. Happy to be serving athletic trainers of the state of Michigan and happy to be here with you guys.
What does that appointment entail for you?
The state athletic trainers board is kind of what oversees the licensing and credentialing of all the athletic trainers in the state. So looking through all the policy procedures with regards to what you have to do to get your license, what you have to do to keep your license, and then some of the regulatory aspects of that.
And when do you take that appointment? Is that an immediate sort of thing?
Yes, this is an immediate start. I think our first meeting is the third week of August.
So you've been not just thrown into the fire with the pandemic at the University of Michigan at the athletic department, but also now the state of Michigan. What type of is there more that you're going to have to do simply because of the pandemic, other than just the regulatory? Hey, how do guys or gals get licensed as athletic trainers?
No, I don't think there's anything more. I think it's just a continuous effort. The board's been around for probably 12 or 15 years, I think, that there's been licensure in the state of Michigan. So the board's been around, and they meet 5 or 6 times a year to continue the efforts with regards to licensure and what has to be done in the state.
Well, congratulations. That's a great honor, and we're proud to have you on there. We saw last week, first, I guess, in terms of just the athletic department, let's start with how are things going with more and more student-athletes coming back and in regards to testing and the protocol of getting them in and out of the athletic facilities?
The protocol is going well. You know, as more and more students have come back and as we're doing more and more tests, you know, we are seeing more positives. I think the good thing is that we still really haven't seen student athletes that get sick. The majority of the positives have come from people who are asymptomatic. We have seen some student athletes that have begun to have some symptoms, but they haven't been real bad symptoms. They've been very mild or subtle symptoms.
And the ones that have tested positive, is that from, hey, they just came back from wherever home was or wherever they were training, or is that from, or could it possibly be from being on campus?
We've had a wide range. We've had 6 student athletes that have tested positive, kind of what we call an entry positive. Mm-hmm. We've had 8 student athletes that have shown some symptoms or reported some symptoms that we then go and test them and they've come out positive. We've had 4 student athletes that have tested positive as part of our quarantine surveillance program, meaning they were already on quarantine from a close contact or exposure with somebody that was positive, and then we test them halfway through, not really to get them out of quarantine, but more for the cardiac side, so we know what cardiac follow-up needs to be done. And then we've had a number of positives. It looks like we've had like 13 positives that were just from our surveillance testing program, meaning that they were here, and then as we start ramping up the surveillance testing, I've been testing them every week. We've had some that have been positive from that.
And the surveillance testing, is that a percentage of the student athletes that are on campus, or is it a set number of individuals that you'll test on a weekly basis?
Right now, where we started was a percentage, and we were going utilizing the School of Public Health and their experts and epidemiologists within public health and Michigan medicine. And we were testing a percentage of student athletes on a weekly basis. As we've now transitioned a little bit from the NCAA, you know, guidelines that came out last week, and Big Ten guidelines are coming out this week, and Power 5 guidelines are coming out this week, and we're privileged enough to have Dr. Samir Afad, our head team physician, sits on those committees along with the Big Ten Infectious Disease Committee. So we got a little preview of what was going to come out. So now we've moved to more of a surveillance testing program based on the risk of the sport and the risk of activity. So our high-risk sports will be tested on a surveillance basis 2 times a week. Our moderate-risk sports will be tested once a week. And then our low-risk sports will be tested either every other week or as needed based on symptoms.
And I'm obviously football, I would assume, would fall into that high risk. Is it the high risk is where there's contact? What makes it a moderate risk and then in low risk?
Basically, it's, you know, the likelihood of coming in, violating that 6-foot bubble mm-hmm. with the student athletes during your activity. So obviously football, wrestling, the basketballs, ice hockey, soccer, field hockey are in that high risk category. Our volleyballs are in the moderate risk category. And volleyball is an interesting, interesting kind of sport in there that if you eliminate, you know, the shaking hands and the high fives after every point in volleyball, that takes volleyball from high risk sport down to a moderate risk sport. So it just lowers the risk just from eliminating that one piece of the game that really doesn't affect the sport. It's more of the celebratory, kind of like what Major League Baseball is doing with the no celebrations after walk offs and stuff like that.
Do you think, and this is just from a former athlete asking somebody that's been around the game or athletics as long as you have, is this going to change how we see? You mentioned the high fives in volleyball and in baseball, the celebratory walk-offs, all of those things. Do you think this will have a lasting effect and change how, whether it's the student athlete or professional athlete, how they interact on the field of play?
I think it'll change a little bit, but I don't think it'll change a lot. I mean, you know, football is still going to be football. You know, I don't think much is going to change in football. If you're banging heads with everybody, you know, every single play and you're in that close contact, I don't think you're not going to celebrate a touchdown, you know, or not high five. I think it'll change sports like volleyball, where you can substantially lower the risks from one activity. I think you'll see some of the other sports like cross country, you know, where they go to time start so that the entire group is not starting at the same time. You know, that's already done in marathons. So, it could be pretty easy to do in cross country. So I think there are going to be some subtle changes like that. But I don't think it's going to drastically change sports, the on-field action.
And we all realize that, you know, we're trying to keep our social distance. We're keeping our masks on. We're making sure that we wash our hands. We're doing all the things that we've been told, you know, is going to help stop the spread and hopefully prevent, you know, individuals from getting it. When you think about basketball, both men's and women's, or, you know, ice hockey and football, when they're in their respective facilities, yeah, they can social distance, but when they play the game, you know, it's, you can't do that, right? You're going to be swapping sweat and you're going to be banging bodies. Why is it then important to social distance when you're in those respective facilities? Say you're in a meeting room, yet you can't when you're on the field. How much does that complicate things?
I don't really think it complicates things. I think we're taking the attitude of that we cannot eliminate all exposures. We know that we can't totally eliminate. Even the NBA, when you're just being put in the bubble, you know, they're eliminating a lot of the exposures and possible exposures of those athletes, but they're not eliminating them all. So I think we understand that we cannot eliminate every single exposure that a person is going to have, but we're trying to mitigate as many as we can. So yes, when you step out on the field for 2 to 3 hours, you're going to be in close contact with people, but you know, if over an entire day, and I'll just throw a number out, and this isn't, there's no science, this number, just because of my math skills. If over an entire day, say, you would have a million exposures over an entire day. You know, if we know that we can't eliminate all million of those exposures, but you know what, if we can eliminate 500,000 of those exposures, that's given you a better chance of not catching the virus. We know you may get 500,000 exposures when you're out on the football field, but you know, off the football field, if we can eliminate some of those exposures that are easier to eliminate, like social distancing, like wearing masks, like using good hand hygiene practices, you know, all of those things. And that's just given us a bigger leg up on helping to mitigate the spread of the virus and helping us to manage it.
Does it amaze you? And maybe you've done this before, because when I was playing, it was one of the viruses that came up was MRSA. And I know that there was a huge effort to clean athletic training rooms, make sure equipment was clean so that, you know, the staff infection wasn't transmitted. when you talk about a million exposures, do you sit there sometimes and think, my goodness, how many times we touch our face or we touch a surface that somebody else may have touched? Does that number shock you sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, it does shock you with regards to touching your face. And I think that's one of the good things with wearing a mask is you probably touch your face less because you have a mask on. Mm-hmm. You know, so it does amaze you when you kind of break it down and watch people and just, you know, watch people for 5 minutes and see how many times they touch their face. Or when they do some of the slow-mo video of just somebody talking and the aerosolization coming out of their mouth when they're talking, and how a mask can help stop that and stop that spread. Or, you know, you've seen tons of slow-mo videos of somebody sneezing.
Yeah.
And the fact that the aerosolization can go up to 13 feet when you sneeze. So how does a mask help that? So those are all things that, you know, we've just learned throughout this process, and probably we haven't learned. We knew that beforehand, but it's really come to the forefront throughout this process.
And now there were four sports that were put on hold or paused, ice hockey, field hockey, volleyball, swimming, and diving. What prompted the holds, and how long will each respective sport be in quarantine?
Well, I mean, what prompted the holds was a significant amount of cases and or quarantines within those specific sports that basically took out a good portion of the team. And just seeing that and understanding the need to try to slow the spread at this time, you know, we placed those sports on pause. Just for, you know, a time period until everybody gets out of quarantine or isolation and we can, you know, have a chance to reevaluate what's going on. You know, the good thing is that there were some positives on those teams, but there weren't a ton of positives. A lot of the people on those teams were placed in quarantine from some of the close contact activities that they had engaged in.
And I think I read that Mel Pearson's ice hockey team, they're initially were supposed to come back this coming week. Is that still true?
Yes, we've started to slowly integrate them as they've come out of quarantine and been retested and tested negative. So we've started to slowly integrate them back into activity. So I think they will start up a little bit more in earnest this week as they've slowly come out of that pause.
And you mentioned some of the things that we already knew in regards to, you know, somebody sneezing or, you know, touching our face, the transmission of germs. We've known that, especially as a parent, right? We tell our kids to cover them when they sneeze or cover when they cough and wash your hands. And we're trying to always do that, but it's really been brought to the forefront. Contact tracing is something that I never really thought of before. What is involved and how are you guys doing the contact tracing?
So it's really a team effort. It's not just one person or one group. So we collaborate very heavily with our Environment Health and Safety Office on campus. They've been, I guess, deputized by the Washtenaw County Health Department to do the contact tracing and be the health department authorities for any on-campus exposure. So we work very closely with them. With regard to the contact tracing and the management of the positive cases. So every athletic trainer on our team and now all of our dietitians are certified contact tracers. So we all took a course from Johns Hopkins to become certified as contact tracers. So that just helps us understand what's going on and really helps us collaborate with them and partner with them to do the contact tracing. So it all starts from, it really starts before there ever is a positive. And why I say that is we've gone to great lengths to put together our workout groups and put together practices around common themes. So if you live in a house of five people, we're going to try to keep that house together for your lifting and strength and conditioning groups and for your individual practice groups. That way we know exactly who's at those workouts. Mm-hmm. And that way, if there is a positive, we can easily trace, okay, you were around this person, this person, this person, this person, because they're in your lifting group. We know you were around who you were from a household contact. And then really the only thing we, only other thing we really have to do is trace who you were around kind of the other 20 hours outside of athletics. So that's really where it starts. And our coaches and our director of ops and our strength coaches have been incredible with the amount of information that we have to be able to know who's living with who, where are they living, everybody's cell phone number, email address, and then really working to get them into groups that make sense and groups that we can trace and keep those groups throughout the summer, and then really working in the facilities to make sure that without even technology, we can pretty much tell you where football players have been in Schembechler. Because we know who has meetings at what time, which way they go. You know, if you've been in Schembechler, all kind of directional arrows of one way in, one way out, so that people aren't crossing paths. And really kind of we directed the traffic flow through the buildings to try to make sure people aren't crossing paths and that we can contact trace pretty easily. Then once there's a positive test, I will get notified, the team's athletic trainer will get notified, and we'll actually start that contact tracing right away. And that starts with just having a conversation with the student athlete who's positive of where have you been outside of athletics? Who's been in your lift group? Who are your roommates? How much time have you spent with your roommates? Who have you been in close contact with outside of what goes on in athletics? And that starts the process. We get that information over to EHS very quickly. EHS will also contact the positive individuals to talk through. Then between ourselves and EHS, we collaborate on, okay, we think these individuals should be quarantined because of close contact. And EHS will agree or disagree or do some more investigation.
How far does the contact tracing go? And that's probably a very broad question, but like, obviously if I were to test positive, you would then, you know, talk to my wife and my kids because we live in the same house. But does it then go to who they've been around as well? I mean, how many different contacts, how deep do you go in the contact list?
We really, for the quarantine, it's really, you know, what's happened the 48 to 72 hours before you've been infectious or before you've shown symptoms. That's really the period that we're most concerned with, is that 48 to 72 hours before you've shown symptoms. That's your major, the start of your infectious period. So generally people are infectious about 2 to 3 days before they start to show symptoms and can stay infectious for up to 10 days after they show symptoms. So that's really the period that we're looking at, is those 2 to 3 days before you started to show symptoms, and then who were you around during that time. And it really kind of breaks it down to their household contacts, which means the people that you live in your household with, their intimate contacts, meaning the people you've been intimate with, and then their what's known as close contacts. So people you've been within that 6-foot bubble for greater than 15 minutes time period. And so those are kind of three different scenarios or different buckets that we'll try to put people in to determine who has to quarantine and who doesn't.
Senior Associate Athletic Director at the University of Michigan, Daryl Conway, has joined us today on Conquering Heroes. He's also the Chief Health and Welfare Officer for the Athletic Department. And Daryl, there's going to be an influx of people coming to Ann Arbor over the next month. How much does that change, or what type of concerns and steps can you take as the regular student body starts to return to Ann Arbor to continue to keep the student athletes safe?
I think the biggest thing we're concentrating on is this education, and really educating the student athletes on what to expect and how to keep themselves safe. You know, we know college students are going to be college students, but how to be a college student safely. And I think the biggest thing that revolves around are, you know, the big three things: wear a mask at all times, keep as much distance as you can from other individuals, and practice good hand hygiene. I think when you do those things, you're going to be safe. And be creative. Figure out how to be a college student while doing those things. You know, and that's been our biggest issue is some of the student athletes aren't doing all three of those things. They may utilize hand sanitizer a lot, but they aren't wearing masks everywhere, or they aren't socially distancing everywhere, and they're still participating in social activities. And that's what we're trying to really reinforce with the student athletes is, this is not normal times. You may have to give up some of your social activities, or you may have to do your social activities in a different manner to stay safe.
When you look at the numbers that you have so far, and for the last email I got, the last update of numbers was there's been 1,005 student athletes, coaches, and staff tested. There's been 29 positive tests. Is it possible to extrapolate those numbers and think if we continue this, you know, along this path, which seems to be, to me, seems to be pretty good, that fall sports, there's a possibility for us to have fall sports?
Yeah, I'd say there's a possibility. I think we need to continue on this path. We need to continue to see numbers stay steady and not drastically increase. Your numbers were correct. We've done 820 tests on student athletes, 1,005 tests total. Of that 820 tests on student athletes, 369 of those were what we call surveillance tests, and 451 of them were what we call entry tests. And yes, we have 30 positives within student athletes. So that's a student athlete positive rate or positive percentage of 3.66%. Which is, generally you look at the rate in the community being somewhere around the overall rate in the community being somewhere around 1%. Mm-hmm. So for the longest time we were under 1%, which put us very, very good that we were under the positive rate in the community. I've heard numbers of the kind of surveillance rate is somewhere around 5%. So 5% of the people you do in surveillance testing may be coming back positive. So we're still a little under that 5% mark. So that's what we're aiming to do is just keep the positives down. And I think with increased testing, I think will help. And just continuing to enhance the education of the student athletes that this is serious. It can have serious health consequences for even the healthiest of the 18 to 22 year olds. And, as the number of positives rise, this costs people seasons and careers and futures. So that's something that we just need to continue to educate on.
And I know that you have, there's different places around the athletic facilities where you go in, you get tested, and then you can go to your office. You can go to your area of practice. I believe there's 19 varsity sports currently active on campus, and that includes the four that the pause button was hit on. When you look at the staff and the amount of mobilization to make that happen, how many hires did you have to make? How much training did you have to do? What went into making that a possibility?
We really didn't hire anyone else because the entire university is on a hiring freeze. So that's been one thing where we've had to redeploy some people in facilities, redeploy some people in compliance and other areas to help out in various different ways. And then there are various varying levels of training that took place with all the different people that were redeployed. It's a huge effort. There are a lot of meetings. What I'll say is it just wasn't me. It was a gargantuan effort of everybody in athletics from every different department to make this happen and to be able to bring student athletes back on campus. And there's not one aspect of the athletic department that wasn't touched, that didn't have input into it, and that doesn't continue to have input and evaluate it. So, you know, it's just everybody working together as a team, and it really not just athletics, but all over campus. You know, I can't say enough about the work that's been done from our UHS, our University Health Service, and our Michigan Medicine, and Dr. Preeti Malani, our Chief Medical Officer, and Dr. Rob Ernst and Lindsay Mortensen, who oversee UHS, because they've been key in our testing. We wouldn't be able to test without UHS and Michigan Medicine, and the work that they've done to get us testing resources and to teach us and to enable us to do that testing. Then, you know, from a facility standpoint and a public relations standpoint, you know, there's so many people that have chipped in to help this campus get back on its feet and start to bring people back and what hopes to be a good fall semester.
Well, Daryl, I really appreciate your time, but I've got one last one for you, and it has nothing to do with testing or surveillance or anything like that. But I heard around the office that there was an Oreo challenge, and I was told that you might have the most interesting flavor, at least one that might interest our listeners the most. What is your favorite flavor that you've tried of Oreos over the last couple of months?
Oh yeah. So, myself and Meg Oblock from, marketing and external relations and Beth Picard. So anytime Ann Villano from compliance, anytime there's a new flavor of Oreo coming out, we run to get it and bring it into the office. So we're very much Oreo aficionados. I'm always a vanilla double stuff or golden double stuff person, but I think the peach cobbler Oreo was my favorite one of all. They did an incredible job of making it taste like a peach cobbler. So, and I'm a fond fan of peach cobbler. So that may have been my favorite flavor of them all.
I got to be honest. I didn't even know there was a peach cobbler Oreo. What's been the worst that you've tried?
Well, I'm not a peanut butter fan, so whatever they did with the peanut butter and jelly, I was not a peanut butter fan. So that was, I didn't even try that one. That one was bad just from the start. You know, I honestly, there really hasn't been, besides for me, the peanut butter and jelly, there really hasn't been a bad Oreo. I can't really think of a bad Oreo that could ever happen. But yeah, I mean, we get on the Oreo site, we track it, we try to figure out what store it's coming out in. That's kind of one of my stops whenever I'm in Walmart or Kroger or Meijer. I always walk by the Oreo aisle to see if there are any new flavors out that I may have missed.
That's amazing. I think that's awesome. And I guess the follow-up question to that before we let you go is, what do you wash it down with?
I'm just a Diet Coke person.
Okay.
Diet Coke or iced tea. I'm not really, I don't like milk. So I'm lactose intolerant. So I don't really drink milk. So I'm just a Diet Coke person to wash it down with. So I'm pretty simple.
Well, Daryl, I appreciate your time today. As we launch the new podcast, Conquering Heroes, our first guest is Senior Associate Athletic Director Daryl Conway, Chief Health and Welfare Officer. And again, congratulations on being appointed to the state's Athletic Trainers Board. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
I want to thank Daryl Conway, the Senior Associate Athletic Director and Chief Health and Welfare Officer for Student Athletes, as well as a new appointee to the state's Athletic Trainers Board. So congratulations to Daryl Conway, and thanks again for joining us here today on Conquering Heroes. I want to send out a couple of more thanks. Obviously, Doug Ganaki, I want to make sure to thank him for providing the opportunity for In the Trenches to bring you Conquering Heroes. Ward Manuel, and as always, you didn't hear from him today, but he is tirelessly working behind the scenes, and that is Brian Bush. A big thanks to him. A lot of work went into making this a possibility. We're excited, and we want to hear from you. So make sure that you subscribe. you write a review, give us some comments, let us know what you want to hear. And I'm going to give you the ways to get in touch with us. Again, you can obviously do it in the comment section, but you can email us at MichiganWolverinesRadio@gmail.com. You can text us 734-328-1760. And as always, you can reach me on Twitter at JohnJansen77. We'll talk to you next week on Conquering Heroes.
Thanks for listening to Conquering Heroes with John Jansen. Conquering Heroes is part of our Michigan Athletics Podcast Network, MGO Blue Podcasts. The preceding is a Learfield IMG College presentation of the Michigan Sports Network.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.